reduce the quantity 1 minus r as a source of error, the more we increase b, and vice versa. Each player's strategy choice concerns the pair of values for b and r that will minimize his expected losses, that is, maximize the expected value of the game for him. Letting V sub R denote the expected value of the game for R, the warning system problem for R is to choose the pair of values for R and B consistent with B equals F times R that maximizes V sub R equals the quantity 1 minus P sub C times the quantity 1 minus P sub R plus P sub R times the quantity 1 minus P sub C times H times the quantity 1 minus R sub C minus P sub C times the quantity 1 minus P sub R times H times the quantity 1 minus R sub R equals the quantity 1 minus A sub C times the quantity 1 minus B sub C times the quantity 1 minus A sub R times the quantity 1 minus B sub R, plus the quantity A sub R plus B sub R minus A sub R times B sub R, times the quantity 1 minus A sub C times the quantity 1 minus B sub C times H times the quantity 1 minus R sub C, minus the quantity A sub C plus B sub C minus A sub C times B sub C times the quantity 1 minus A sub R times the quantity 1 minus B sub R times H times the quantity 1 minus R sub R. Additionally, pursuant to the earlier matrix analysis, R should examine the resulting modified payoff matrix that results from using these optimal values of R sub R and B sub R, together with the observed or expected optimal values of R sub C and B sub C, to see whether joint no attack is still the jointly preferred outcome. The conditions for a joint preference at no attack with optimally adjusted warning systems would be P sub C equals the quantity A sub C plus B sub C minus A sub C times B sub C is less than 1 minus H times the quantity 1 minus R sub C divided by 1 minus H times the quantity R sub R minus R sub C. P sub R equals the quantity A sub R plus B sub R minus A sub R times B sub R is less than 1 minus H times the quantity 1 minus R sub R divided by 1 minus H times the quantity R sub C minus R sub R. With symmetry, the denominators in the right-hand terms become just 1. Actually, as will be seen shortly, this second examination may be unnecessary. For certain behavior hypotheses, optimal adjustment of R and B for any value short of R equals 1 requires that the conditions for stability of the modified matrix be met. It remains to be specified how the players behave. Broadly speaking, we can make either of three hypotheses corresponding more or less to the difference between parametric behavior, a tacit game, and a bargaining game. Dynamic adjustment, parametric behavior. First, we may try supposing that each player takes the probability of being attacked as given, that is, as a parameter and not a variable in his own loss function, and does the same with the reliability of his opponent's warning system. That is, he directly observes the values of his opponent's B and R, and selects the pair of values for own B and R that minimize his expected losses. This assumption tends to make each person's choice of B a rising function of the probability that the other will attack. It only tends to, since there is a possibility that the corresponding change in the other's R provides an offsetting inducement, as mentioned shortly. If we think of the two players as continually adjusting their values of B and R, each with an eye on the other's B and R, but always responding parametrically to the current probability of being attacked and not projecting the other's behavior as a function of his own, we get a simple dynamic multiplier system, stable or explosive depending on the parameter values and shape of the F function. We can express each player's optimum value of B as a function of the other's, solve the two equations, and deduce the stability conditions for the equilibrium. We can also compute multipliers relating each player's changes of B and R to shifts in the F function, or to changes in the A parameters. Explicitly, to find the parametric behavior function for player R, we maximize V sub R with respect to R sub R, subject to B sub R equaling the function of R sub R, but treating B sub C and R sub C as fixed. Using the formula given earlier for V sub R, we get the figure found in the supplement. Since F prime is presumed positive, the denominator must be positive if V sub R is to be maximized with R less than 1. But the condition that the denominator be positive is precisely the condition that P sub C must meet in order that player R still prefer joint no attack. Thus, if both players have optimal adjustments with R less than 1, those optimal values of R and B are also perforce consistent with joint preference at no attack. The relation of B sub R to B sub C under this behavior hypothesis, that is, the slope of the resulting function that yields R's optimal B value for given values of B sub C, is obtained by differentiating both sides of the previous equation. This result is also in the supplement. Since the partial derivative of F prime divided by the partial derivative of R sub C is negative, small values of phi prime may make player R's D times B sub R divided by D times B sub C negative. It does so by raising the cost of inadvertent attack enough to outweigh the increase in the risk of being attacked. In other words, B sub R is a function not just of B sub C, but of phi times B sub C as well. B sub R tends to be increased for a rise in B sub C, but lowered for a rise in R sub C, while B sub C and R sub C rise together as we consider moving out the B sub C axis. A stable equilibrium requires that player R's D times B sub R divided by D times B sub C, and C's D times B sub C divided by D times B sub R, should have a product less than 1. That is, that with B sub R measured vertically and B sub C horizontally, C's curve should intersect R's from below. The general multiplier expression relating changes in the B's and R's to shifts in the functions, or to changes in the values of the A's, contains 1 minus this product in the denominator. As remarked earlier, the denominator in the expression for F prime disappears, and R sub R, B sub R, and F prime rise sharply, as H approaches the condition for an unstable matrix. Actually, stability of the matrix game, as distinct from stability of a parametric behavior equilibrium, is not a relevant concept for the parametric behavior hypothesis. To contemplate the matrix and to anticipate the other's action is to project his behavior, not to observe it and adapt to it. It may also be noted that player R may ignore A sub R in his calculations. It drops out of the formula for optimum B sub R and R sub R. Intuitively, this is because the only contingency in which either the value of R sub R or the value of B sub R can make any difference is the contingency that R not launch irrational attack. If he does, B and R are irrelevant to him, However, A sub R does affect the condition for a stable matrix, since it does enter into the condition that P sub R must meet. So, in projecting C's adjustment, R would have to take A sub R into account. But projecting C's behavior, rather than just observing B sub C and R sub C continuously, would make R's behavior non-parametric, contradicting the present hypothesis. If player R were considering the value of spending money to improve his warning system, A sub R would affect the calculation, since it affects the probability that the system makes any difference. This consideration is outside the present model. A tacit game. We can make another behavior hypothesis, which may lead to the same result. Instead of supposing that each player sees how the others R and B are adjusted, takes them as given, and responds to them, we can suppose that each player knows the technological opportunities of the other player, the functional relation between R and B for the other player, but cannot reliably observe how the other has adjusted the values of R and B. That is, each understands the mechanics of the other's warning system, but can never be sure just what instructions the other has given on how to interpret the evidence that comes in over the system. The other's decision rule. This hypothesis yields us a non-cooperative game in which each player must choose a value for B, that is, for R, not knowing what value the other has chosen, but knowing the other's payoff matrix. In this case, we have a payoff matrix with an equilibrium point at precisely the point, if any, where the parametric behavior hypothesis yielded a stable equilibrium. In other words, what was the solution under the parametric behavior hypothesis is still a candidate for being called a solution in the non-cooperative form of the game. In neither case is the equilibrium point necessarily unique. If it is not, the first hypothesis makes the outcome depend on initial conditions and shocks. The second tends to complicate the intellectual problem of identifying solution strategies. This solution, of course, is inefficient for the two players. It is an example of prisoner's dilemma mentioned previously. Reciprocal increases in the values of the Bs have simply raised the likelihood of attack by each side. There are lesser values for the two Bs that would make both parties better off, and if the probabilities of deliberate sneak attack by the two players are equal, A's are equal, an agreement to have no warning system at all, that is, no possibility of false alarm, would be the preferred bargain for the two parties if they were restricted to bargains that gave them identical warning systems. A bargaining game. If we consider the possibility of the two players negotiating to reduce the sensitivity of their alert systems in the interest of mutual reductions in B at the cost of smaller R's, and assuming that enforcement of such an agreement were possible, there is no very convincing way of deriving a unique solution without further specification of the bargaining framework. If the solution has to be symmetrical and the game is symmetrical, that is, if they negotiate over a common pair of values for R and B, the result is as just mentioned, zero values for B, even if this means zero for R, no warning system at all. If warning systems are to be identical, there is some critical difference between the basic probabilities of deliberate sneak attack for the two people, between A sub R and A sub C, beyond which a side payment would be required for an agreement on the abolition of warning systems. But in general, this becomes a wide-open bargaining problem. It is even wider open than the present formulation suggests, since the players may not only manipulate values of R and B, but of course can now threaten direct attack or operate on the institutional arrangements that determine the values of the A's. There is an enforcement difficulty with any agreement on reduction of values of R and B in the mutual interest, It is that each other's values of R and B may not be observable. They depend, at least to an important extent, on the criteria that will govern future decisions, not solely on the observable physical mechanics of an alert system. They depend on how long one will wait to be sure and on what risks one will accept in an emergency. Furthermore, failure to keep the agreement, if it leads to anything, leads to war itself. So, recriminations and damage suits are out of the question if our model represents all-out war rather than a border scrape or a minor transgression of one partner against another. It might be that R equals B equals zero is qualitatively observable, the physical absence of any system at all. Even this possibility is unavailable as an enforceable system if the matrix is unstable with R equaling zero, that is, with H greater than one. In that case, some risk in the form of B is necessary to put the R's safely in the range where H times the quantity 1 minus R is less than 1. It may also be difficult to have an agreement that explicitly recognizes the A's, since it may be politically difficult to admit that one's A is above zero. The players may be driven then to rely on arrangements that either observably blunt their own capacity for surprise, or observably improve their own and each other's transformation curves relating R to the quantity 1 minus B. Both sides may, for example, agree to spend more on the alert system to make it more efficient, and the richer side may prefer to finance improvements in the other's alert system rather than leave it in a form that either aggravates the other's sense of insecurity or makes him susceptible to false alarm. An agreement to design forces that have no surprise attack potential but instead have improved vulnerability to surprise attack themselves would seem to be indicated. That is, instead of making R and B the terms of an agreement, they might be forced by the unobservability of R and B to work on the F and Phi functions themselves, considering each of these functions to involve both one's own alert system and the enemy's or partner's attack force. It should be noted, however, that innovations in the warning systems, shifts of the F and Phi functions in the direction of less B for a given level of R and vice versa, are not in all cases stabilizing. Those that raise the marginal cost of R may lead to higher values of B. These would be perverse innovations from the point of view of the two players together, analogous to an improvement in the prisoner's dilemma matrix that raises each player's payoff for non-cooperative strategies. The bargaining game formulation also lends itself to bargaining tactic analysis. For example, if one player acts parametrically and the other knows it and takes it into account, the first displays a reaction function, which goes into the other's formula for V, which the latter tries to maximize. In general, the analysis of strategic moves of the kind discussed in chapters 2, 5, and 7 are relevant to this version of the surprise attack partnership discipline game. More than two players. An interesting variant of the problem would occur if the number of players were increased, or if a third player were brought in as an autonomous agent. To the extent that attack from other quarters must be anticipated, the incentive toward mutual reduction of alert systems is reduced. It remains true, however, that any two players in a larger game can find some advantage in jointly modifying their alert systems in the direction of lesser danger of false alarm by taking into account the external diseconomies for each other that they leave out of account when behaving parametrically. Two armed watchmen patrolling the same building, each subject to some temptation to shoot on sight, would be better off if they could find some way of reaching an enforceable agreement to be a little less ready to shoot on sight, to reduce the likelihood of shooting each other. Actually, the two watchmen problem is a representation of our original model, if we let our original parameters, P sub C and P sub R, represent the relative likelihoods that a man met in darkness is a burglar rather than the other watchman. We have to introduce some uncertainty about a burglar's behavior. That is, to let him join the game as a rational third participant trying to anticipate the other's decisions, in order to add complications to what we already had. Chapter 10. Surprise Attack and Disarmament. Disarmament has covered a variety of schemes, some ingenious and some sentimental, for cooperation among potential enemies to reduce the likelihood of war or to reduce its scope and violence. Most proposals have taken as a premise that a reduction in the quantity and potency of weapons, particularly of offensive weapons and of weapons that either deliberately or incidentally cause great civilian agony and destruction, promotes this purpose. Some schemes have been comprehensive. Others have sought to identify particular areas where the common interest is conspicuous, where the need for trust is minimal, and where a significant start might be made which, if successful, would be a first step toward more comprehensive disarmament. Among these less comprehensive schemes, measures to safeguard against surprise attack have, since the President's first open skies proposal in 1955, come increasingly into prominence. The focus on surprise attack has not reflected an abandonment of interest in a more ambitious dismantlement of arms. Rather, it represents the philosophy of picking an area where success is most likely in order to establish some tradition of successful cooperation. The search for safeguards against surprise attack has generally been considered in our government and elsewhere, not as an alternative to disarmament, but as a type of disarmament and a possible step toward more. Nevertheless, though schemes to avert surprise attack may be in the tradition of disarmament, they represent something of an innovation. The original Open Skies proposal was unorthodox in its basic idea that arms themselves are not provocative so long as they are clearly held in reserve, so long as their stance is deterrent rather than aggressive. The proposal was also unorthodox in its dramatic reminder that, important as it may be to keep secrets from an enemy, and in some matters to keep him guessing about what our plans are, it can be even more important to see that the enemy is not left to speculate about our intentions toward surprise attack against him if, in fact, we are not planning any such attack. We are interested not only in assuring ourselves with our own eyes that he is not preparing an attack against us. We are interested as well in assuring him through his own eyes that we are preparing no deliberate attack against him. The importance of not keeping that particular secret has an analog in our alleged political inability to attack first. As General Leslie R. Groves remarked in a speech, "If Russia knows we won't attack first, the Kremlin will be very much less apt to attack us. Our reluctance to strike first is a military disadvantage to us, but it is also, paradoxically, a factor in preventing a world conflict today. We live in an era in which a potent incentive on either side, perhaps the main incentive, to initiate total war with a surprise attack is the fear of being a poor second for not going first. Self-defense becomes peculiarly compounded if we have to worry about his striking us to keep us from striking him to keep him from striking us. The surprise attack problem, when viewed as a problem of reciprocal suspicion and aggravated self-defense, suggests that there are not only secrets we prefer not to keep, but military capabilities we might prefer not to have. Of course, it is even better if the other side does not have them either. So there may be advantages in thinking of the surprise attack problem as one suitable for negotiation. The innovation in the surprise attack approach goes further. It has to do with what the scheme is designed to protect and what armaments it takes for granted. An anti-surprise attack scheme has as its purpose not just to make attack more difficult, but to reduce or eliminate the advantage of striking first. It must assume that if the advantage of striking first can be eliminated or severely reduced, the incentive to strike at all will be reduced. It is widely accepted that the United States has the military power virtually to obliterate the USSR, and vice versa. And it is widely accepted that if either side struck the other a major nuclear blow, the nation so hit would have a powerful incentive to strike back with equal or greater force. But if either side can obliterate the other, what does it matter who strikes first? The answer, of course, is that we are not particularly concerned with outliving the Russians by a day. We are worried about whether a surprise attack might have such prospects of destroying the power to retaliate as to be undeterred itself by the threat of retaliation. It is not in our existing capacity to destroy Russia that deters a Russian attack against us, but our capacity to retaliate after being attacked ourselves. We must assume that a Russian first strike, if it came, would be aimed at the very power that we rely upon for retaliation. There is a difference between a balance of terror, in which either side can obliterate the other, and one in which both sides can do it no matter who strikes first. It is not the balance, the sheer equality or symmetry in the situation, that constitutes mutual deterrence. It is the stability of the balance. The balance is stable only when neither, in striking first, can destroy the other's ability to strike back. The difference between a stable and an unstable balance is illustrated by another offensive weapon against which no good defense was ever devised. The equalizer of the Old West made it possible for either man to kill the other. It did not assure that both would be killed. The tense consequences of this weapon system can be seen on TV almost any night. The advantage of shooting first aggravates any incentive to shoot. As the survivor might put it, he was about to kill me in self-defense, so I had to kill him in self-defense. Or he, thinking I was about to kill him in self-defense, was about to kill me in self-defense, so I had to kill him in self-defense. But if both were assured of living long enough to shoot back with unimpaired aim, there would be no advantage in jumping the gun, and little reason to fear that the other would try it. The special significance of surprise attack thus lies in the possible vulnerability of retaliatory forces. If these forces were themselves invulnerable, if each side were confident that its own forces could survive an attack, but also that it could not destroy the other's power to strike back, there would be no powerful temptation to strike first. And there would be less need to react quickly to what might prove to be a false alarm. Thus, schemes to avert surprise attack have as their most immediate objective the safety of weapons rather than the safety of people. Surprise attack schemes, in contrast to other types of disarmament proposals, are based on deterrence as the fundamental protection against attack. They seek to perfect and to stabilize mutual deterrence to enhance the integrity of particular weapon systems. And it is precisely the weapons most destructive of people that an anti-surprise attack scheme seeks to preserve, the weapons of retaliation, the weapons whose mission is to punish rather than to fight, to hurt the enemy afterwards, not to disarm him beforehand. A weapon that can hurt only people and cannot possibly damage the other side's striking force is profoundly defensive. It provides its possessor no incentive to strike first. It is the weapon that is designed or deployed to destroy military targets, to seek out the enemy's missiles and bombers, that can exploit the advantage of striking first and consequently provide a temptation to do so. In identifying the surprise attack problem as the possible vulnerability of each side's retaliatory forces to surprise, we are at the point where measures against surprise attack differ drastically from more conventional notions of disarmament. We are also at the source of a number of anomalies and paradoxes that have to be faced if we are to recognize the virtues and defects of particular schemes and to comprehend the motives behind them. It is at this point also that we begin to question whether schemes against surprise attack can be viewed as first steps toward more comprehensive disarmament in the traditional sense, or instead are incompatible with other forms of disarmament. Can measures to protect SAC be viewed as first steps toward its dismantlement? Can we initially take cooperative measures to perfect and safeguard each side's capacity to retaliate massively in the interest of mutual deterrence and do it as a step toward eliminating the threat of massive retaliation from a tense and troubled world? Or should we instead recognize measures to safeguard against surprise attack as a compromise, an implicit acceptance of mutual deterrence as the best source of military stability we are likely to find, and a recognition that, though we may not be able to replace the balance of terror with anything better, there may be much that we can do to make that balance stable rather than unstable? Once we have identified the surprise attack problem as the possible vulnerability of either side's retaliatory force to a first strike by the other, it becomes necessary to evaluate military strength, defensive measures, and proposals for the inspection or limitation of armament with precisely this type of strategic vulnerability in mind. We do not, for example, assess American and Soviet strategic forces by counting up the bombers, missiles, submarines, and aircraft carriers on both sides, as though we wanted to see who could put on the most impressive peacetime parade. Who is ahead in the arms race will usually be whoever strikes first. And if we have to plan on the conservative assumption that the other side will strike first, 200 bombers safe against attack may be worth as much as 2,000 that have only a 10% chance of survival. An assessment of defensive measures also comes out differently if we put primary reliance on deterrence. Chicago cannot be hidden, buried in a blast-proof cavern, or kept 10 miles off the ground. But concealment, dispersal, hard shelter, and airborne alert are meaningful defenses in preserving the deterrent force. An active air defense of Chicago that has only a 50-50 chance of saving the city from a multi-megaton bomb would be a discouraging prospect, and we have little promise that we could even do that well. But an active defense that could guarantee the survival of a large fraction of our strategic striking force might be more than enough to guarantee the Russians a prohibitive cost in retaliation. Similarly, a defense of Chicago that requires the enemy to triple the size of his attack may be a poor prospect. It may mean only that he invests in a larger initial attack. But a defense of our retaliatory force that requires the enemy to triple the size of his attack may substantially increase the enemy's difficulty of sneaking past our warning system and appreciably change his likelihood of successfully precluding retaliation. The same kind of calculation is pertinent to an evaluation of arms limitations. If we look only at the problem of a Russian attack on American cities, it may seem immaterial to the enemy whether he shoots his ICBMs from close up or from afar. Accuracy may not make much difference with a multi-megaton bomb fired at metropolitan areas. But if he is trying to destroy a missile or bomber that has been sheltered deep underground with reinforced concrete, accuracy is no longer superfluous. An average aiming error of 2 or 3 miles may be nothing in shooting at a large metropolitan area. An attempt to knock out a hard-sheltered retaliatory weapon may require several missiles to get a direct enough hit. Thus, zonal limitations on the placement of ICBMs might seem an ineffectual form of disarmament in the conventional sense. But in stabilizing deterrence, in reducing the vulnerability of each side's retaliatory forces to the other's forces, the separation of each side's missile sites from the others, by reducing accuracy, might make a real difference. For unsheltered planes or missiles, of course, the city target analogy is unfortunately pertinent. On some questions, emphasis on the surprise attack problem may lead to a downright reversal of the answer that one would get from more traditional disarmament considerations. Consider the case of a limitation on the number of missiles that might be allowed to both sides. If we ever reached the point in negotiations with Russia where an agreement limiting the number of missiles were pertinent and inspection seemed feasible, suppose we had decided from a consideration of population targets and enemy incentives that we would need a minimum expectation of 100 missiles left over after his first counter-missile strike in order to carry out an adequately punitive retaliatory strike, that is, to deter him from striking in the first place. For illustration, suppose his accuracies and reliabilities are such that one of his missiles has a 50-50 chance of knocking out one of ours. Then, if we have 200, he needs to knock out just over half. At 50% reliability, he needs to fire just over 200 to cut our residual supply to less than 100. If we had 400, he would need to knock out three-quarters of ours. At a 50% discount rate for misses and failures, he would need to fire more than twice 400, that is, more than 800. If we had 800, he would have to knock out 7/8 of ours, and to do it with 50% reliability, he would need over 3 times that number, or more than 2,400, and so on. The larger the initial number on the defending side, the larger the multiple required by the attacker in order to reduce the victim's residual supply to below some safe number. From this point of view, a limitation on the number of missiles would appear to be more stabilizing, the larger the number permitted. This would be so for 2 reasons. First, the larger the number on both sides, the greater is the absolute number of missiles expected to be left over for retaliation in the event that either side should strike first, and therefore the greater is the deterrence to an attempted first strike. Second, the larger the number of missiles on both sides, the greater must be the absolute and proportionate increase in missiles that either side would have to achieve in order to be capable of assuring, with any specified probability, that the other's leftover missiles would be less than some specified number after being attacked. Thus, the difficulty of one side's cheating by disguising and concealing extra missiles, or breaking the engagement and racing to achieve a dominant number, is more than proportionately enhanced by any increase in the starting figures on both sides. In fact, if the numbers to begin with are high enough to strain the budgetary capacities of the two enemies, and within these budgetary capacities the number of missiles is high, stability might be imposed by the economic limitation on what either side could do relative to what it would have to do to achieve mastery. Here is a case, then, in which an arms race does not necessarily lead to a more and more unstable situation. For anything like equal numbers on both sides, the likelihood of successfully wiping out the other side's missiles becomes less and less as the missiles on both sides increase, and the tolerance of the system increases too. For small numbers on both sides, a ratio of 2 or 3 to 1 may provide dominance to the larger side, a chance of striking first and leaving the other side a small absolute number for striking back. But if the initial numbers on both sides are higher, it may take a ratio of 10 to 1 rather than 2 or 3 to 1 to have a good chance of striking with impunity. Neither side needs to panic if it falls behind a little bit, and neither has any great hope that it could draw far enough ahead to have the kind of dominance it would need. This greatly simplified view of a missile duel is much too specialized to be a strong argument for arms races rather than disarmament, but it does demonstrate that within the logic of stable deterrence and of schemes for the prevention of surprise attack, the question of more versus fewer weapons has to be analyzed on its merits in individual cases. It is not a foregone conclusion that disarmament, in the literal sense, leads to stability. Our attitude toward missile submarines and toward the problem of devising submarine detection techniques should be much affected by whether we are worried about enemy attack or enemy surprise attack. If the submarine proves to be for many years a fairly invulnerable site for anti-population missiles, we should perhaps view it not as an especially terrifying development, but as a reassuring one. If, in fact, the best we can hope for is mutual deterrence and we only want the balance to be stable, then the Polaris-type missile carried by a submarine of great mobility and endurance may be the kind of weapon system that we should like to see in adequate numbers on both sides. If it should prove to be both undetectable and highly reliable, it would have the advantage of not needing to strike first in order to strike at all, of not fearing that an aggressor might hope to knock out the very forces that were supposed to deter him. True, it might seem more reassuring if we had the power to destroy the enemy's missile subs while he did not have the power to destroy ours. But if the power already exists on both sides, and we cannot wish it away, then the most we can hope for is that this capacity to destroy each other be itself sufficiently indestructible that each side is in fact deterred. From that point of view, we perhaps should not even wish that we alone could have the invulnerable nuclear weapon submarine. If, in fact, we have either no intention or no political capacity for a first strike, it would usually be helpful if the enemy were confidently assured of this. His own manifest invulnerability to our first strike could be to our advantage if it relieved him of a principal concern that might motivate him to try striking first. If he has to worry about the exposure of his strategic force to a surprise attack by us, we have to worry about it too. These thoughts also affect our attitude toward the search for submarine detection. The Navy is urgently seeking a better system of defense against submarines, and there is no question but that we have to devote ourselves intently to the problem. Yet, perhaps we ought simultaneously to hope that the problem is insoluble. If it were insoluble, in the relative sense in which a technical problem can ever be insoluble, and submarines were destined to be comparatively safe vehicles for a decade or so, stable deterrence might be technologically possible. If submarines prove to be vulnerable themselves, arms technology is less stable than we hope. We have to try to detect submarines because we cannot afford to let the Russians find a technique that we do not know, and because we have to learn all we can about detection to make our submarines less detectable. But, like a person who has entered into an agreement with a partner that he cannot trust, we may search like the devil for a loophole, knowing that our partner is searching just as hard, while hoping that no loophole is found. Once we have pressed the argument this far, we may as well carry it all the way. If our problem is to guarantee to an enemy that we have the ability to strike a punitive blow after being struck ourselves, and to assure him that we know that he knows it, so that we are under no temptation to doubt the potency of our own deterrence and strike first, we should find virtue in technological discoveries that enhance the anti-population potency of our retaliatory weapons. If it is logical to take measures to guarantee that a larger proportion of our retaliatory forces could survive a first strike on them, the same logic should make us welcome an increase in the potency of those that do survive. As Bernard Brody has said, when we consider the special requirements of deterrence with its emphasis on the punitive aspect of retaliation, we may find a need even for super-dirty bombs, since the emphasis must be on making certain that the enemy will fear even the smallest number of bombs that might be sent in retaliation. One wants these bombs to be, and thus to appear before the event, as horrendous as possible. The novelty of this reasoning disappears as soon as we recognize that the balance of terror, if it is stable, is simply a massive and modern version of an ancient institution, the exchange of hostages. In older times, one committed himself to a promise by delivering his hostages physically into the hands of his distrustful partner. Today's military technology makes it possible to have the lives of a potential enemy's women and children within one's grasp, while he keeps those women and children thousands of miles away. As long as each side has the manifest power to destroy a nation and its population in response to an attack by the other, the balance of terror amounts to a tacit understanding backed by a total exchange of all conceivable hostages. We may not, of course, want to exchange quite that many hostages in support of this particular understanding with this particular enemy. But in a lawless world that provides no recourse to damage suits for breach of this unwritten contract, hostages may be the only device by which mutually distrustful and antagonistic partners can strike a bargain. This line of reasoning is not simply an enormous rationalization for an arms race. It does indeed suggest that disarmament, in the literal sense, aimed indiscriminately at weapons of all kinds, or even selectively aimed at the most horrifying weapons of mass destruction, could produce instability rather than stability, and might have to be completely successful in order not to be disastrous. Nevertheless, there is an important area of arms limitations that is not only compatible with the foregoing analysis, but is suggested by it. It suggests making a distinction between the kinds of weapons that are peculiarly suitable to the exploitation of a first strike, and weapons that are peculiarly suitable to the retaliatory role. At one extreme is the pure strike-back type of weapon, the relatively inaccurate vehicle with a super-dirty bomb that can kill just about everything in the enemy's country except a well-protected or well-hidden retaliatory force, and that itself is so well-protected or well-hidden as to be invulnerable to any weapons that the other side might possess. Ideally, this weapon would suffer no disadvantage in waiting to strike second and gain no advantage in striking first. At the opposite extreme is a weapon that is itself so vulnerable that it could not survive to strike second, or a weapon so specialized for finding and destroying the enemy's retaliatory forces before they are launched that it would lose most of its usefulness if it were held until the other side has already started. These strike-first weapons not only give their possessor a powerful incentive to strike first, and an incentive to jump the gun in the event of ambiguous warning rather than to wait and make absolutely sure, they are a tacit declaration to the enemy that one expects to strike first. They consequently invite the enemy to strike a little before that, and to act with haste in the event he thinks that we think it's time to act quickly. Between the extremes of the pure strike-first weapon and the pure strike-back weapon, there are the weapons that can strike first but do not need to, that can survive and serve the retaliatory purpose, but that also might have an important effect on the other side's retaliatory forces if used first. Perhaps most weapons fall in this category if reasonable precautions are taken for their protection. So we cannot make a nice distinction between first strike and second strike weapons, extolling the one and disparaging the other in our approach to the surprise attack problem. If we were to consider eliminating all weapons that had any possible effect against the other side's retaliatory forces, or that enjoyed any advantage in being used first, there might not be enough left with which to promise retaliation. But surprise attack negotiations might usefully concentrate on the opposite extreme. The most obvious candidates would be exposed, vulnerable weapons. It might seem anomalous to insist to the Russians that they cover any nakedness of their strategic forces, or for them to suggest that we protect better some of our own. More likely would be suggestions to abandon weapons that were provocatively exposed to the other side. Note how different in spirit this would be from the ban-the-bomb orientation. Whatever the propaganda implications of such a topic, it at least has the merit of viewing deterrence as something to be enhanced, not dismantled. Second, restrictions on the deployment of forces that affect their counterforce potency rather than their counterpopulation potency might be sought. They will not be sought, however, until there is candid recognition that surprise attack schemes are to be deliberately aimed at protecting, not degrading, each side's strike-back capability. The previous discussion of the effect of range on missile requirements, whatever its specific merits, suggests that this class of limitations is not an empty one. Third, there may be some useful exploration of cooperative measures or mutually accommodated modes of behavior that reduce the danger of war by misapprehension. Even voluntary exchange of information might help if we and the Russians can unilaterally pick modes of behavior that, when the truth is known, are reassuring. This is presumably the idea behind proposals for inspection of air traffic in the North Polar area, and there may be some other types of activity in which there could be mutual benefit from some traffic rules. What is attractive about these measures, as about a candid discussion of the evils of strike-first weapon systems, is that they may make possible some understandings that do not have to be embodied in formal agreements, and may facilitate unilateral accommodations on both sides. Fourth, there may be arrangements to cope with crises and emergencies that threaten to explode into an unintended war. A later section of this chapter discusses this point at some length. Fifth, there may be measures that, by making surprise less likely, make a first strike less attractive. This point brings us back to the open skies type of proposal. Most public discussion of the surprise attack problem during the last few years has related to measures that might reduce the likelihood of surprise rather than measures to limit what weapons could do if surprise were achieved. The Open Skies proposal was based on the idea that with sufficient observation of each other's military forces, neither side could achieve surprise, and lacking the advantage of surprise would be deterred. The technical problem of devising a practical inspection scheme that could yield each side adequate warning of an attack by the other has become much more difficult since the first Open Skies proposal was made. With hydrogen weapons reducing the number of aircraft that might be needed in a surprise attack, with missiles promising to reduce the total time available between the initial actions in readying a strike and the explosion of weapons on target, and with mobile systems like missile submarines to keep under surveillance, it looks as though pure inspection unaccompanied by any limits on the behavior of the things to be inspected would be enormously difficult or enormously ineffectual. The idea of examining photographs for strategic indications of force movements and concentrations is simply obsolete. The problem now would seem to be one of intensive surveillance of strategic forces by a vast organization that could transmit authentic messages reporting suspicious activity within at most a few hours, and eventually within a few minutes, in a way that is not intolerably susceptible of false alarms. There is no practical assurance that this could be done. This does not mean that inspection schemes against surprise attack have no prospect of success. What it means is that a scheme providing for nothing but inspection may have very poor prospects. But if one cannot send observers out to follow all the aircraft, missiles, and submarines wherever they go, one can still consider calling the aircraft, missiles, and submarines to assemble where they are more easily watched. If restrictions on the deployment of forces are used to make the task of inspection more manageable, something may be accomplished. But though there may be promise in the idea of combining inspection and weapon limitations, there are also serious problems. One is a possible incompatibility between the need for inspection and the need for concealment. When missiles become sufficiently accurate, it may become almost physically impossible to protect one's own retaliatory forces by the sheer provision of cement, or, if not impossible, exceedingly costly. Mobility and concealment may then have to be the source of security for the retaliatory forces. If the enemy can hit anything he can locate and kill anything he can hit, he has to be made unable to locate it. To the extent that he can have our own retaliatory weapons under continuous surveillance, he has continuous information on their location. In other ways, an inspection scheme on the scale required for protection against surprise attack might yield excessive information about the disposition of the other's forces and make them more vulnerable. It is widely known, for example, that there was a time when hurricane winds immobilized an extremely large portion of the B-36s that then comprised our principal retaliatory threat. The implications for surprise attack of such an event are evidently very different, depending on whether the enemy knows only in a general way that this kind of thing can happen to us, or instead has definite information when it occurs, and knows exactly whether or not he has clear sailing for a few days. Imagine the state of tension that could occur if either side's strategic force personnel began to suffer a severe epidemic that threatened to immobilize them temporarily before the eyes of the other side's inspection. Much better, if we and they are occasionally to land in a very unalert position for reasons that are impossible to prevent, that neither of us should be in a position to know too much about the other's occasional disabilities. Finally, while there may be arrangements that have a high probability of providing warning of the enemy's preparation for an attack, the value of the system depends on what we can do if we do get warning. We can send off our own anticipatory strike, hoping to get in first. But this is an unattractive course if the warning is ambiguous. A false alarm then leads to war, and a true one precludes any last-minute deterrence. At the other extreme, we can just wait and get ready. And if the things we can do to get ready appreciably reduce the likelihood that his attack will succeed, if they raise the likelihood that we can retaliate severely, we may want to make a quick demonstration to the enemy that we are ready, in the hope that our improved posture will deter his final decision. The important question is what we do that constitutes getting ready. If the answer is simply, be more alert, why weren't we more alert in the first place? Most of the obvious things that one would do if he had warning of an attack are things that one probably would like to do perpetually in view of the ever-present possibility of an attack. And if our Strategic Air Command is continually doing its best to reduce the time it takes to get aircraft ready and off the ground in the face of warning, or to keep the doors tightly shut on sheltered aircraft, or to keep aircraft safe in the air in combat-ready condition, there may not be much more they can do on short notice. Nevertheless, there are things that a nation can do in the face of imminent attack that it could not do continuously and indefinitely. One can evacuate or go underground, but not forever. One can get his retaliatory forces safely off the ground, where they are no longer targets for enemy bombs, but they cannot stay in the air forever. One can put men on 24-hour duty, but not for many days in a row. One can ground all commercial aircraft to raise the reliability of the warning system, but the economic loss might be exorbitant if commercial and private flying were forsworn for all time in the interest of making enemy aircraft more recognizable. There are, in other words, things that one can do to get ready in the face of expected attack that one cannot be expected to do continuously. But there is another question. How long can we keep it up? Suppose we cannot physically keep all aircraft in the air at all times, as is true, and that it may be too costly in all respects, accidents as well as fuel and crews, to keep as many as half of them in the sky on the average, but that a substantial increase in the number aloft can be effected on short notice if a serious warning is received. This might well mean that the enemy would not be deterred by our ordinary posture, but would be deterred by the posture we can adopt when we get warning. Does this mean that he quits as soon as he sees that we are ready? Or might he just wait until the gas is gone, the pilots are tired, and the planes have to come down again? And if so, must we not strike in anticipation? This problem of fatigue is likely to plague any super-alert stance that one can take. The solution is in two parts. First, one must try to design a super alert response that has good endurance and little fatigue, recognizing that this means compromising its peak effectiveness. Second, and most pertinent to the present subject, one may have to engage in a kind of crash disarmament negotiation with the enemy during the period that one has in fact taken measures to ensure his own invulnerability of retaliation. If we can keep up a super alert for a few days, we have a few days during which to attempt to demand or negotiate some degree of Russian disarmament that is both tolerable to them and sufficiently reassuring to us to permit us to return to normal.